Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner.
I'm Anthony McCarthy.
And welcome back to the second part of our program today. And we're going to jump back into the city council discussion in the future of Baltimore City for about 10 more minutes, then jump into the governor's situation for a little bit here on the air, and then talk about what most people don't remember. This is the 60th anniversary of the first sit-in in America in 1960 in Greensboro, North Carolina. And we're going to, 50th anniversary, excuse me, we're going to talk about that when we return. Later on in the program, that'll be part of our conversation. But right now, let's turn this over to WEA Traffic, and we'll come right back to the discussion.
Support for WEAA is provided by Luna. Information on flooring but available at luna.com/traffic or 877-241-LUNA.
Bit lighter than usual on northbound 95 from the Beltway through White Marsh. The update brought to you by Advil PM. It's still heavy on northbound 95 between the 895 merge and the Beltway. Beltway interloop on the brakes, 95 to Wilkins Avenue, and again from Baltimore National Pike to Liberty. Interloop also seeing a lot of activity right now between the JFX and Paring Parkway. Outer loop, a busy ride from Delaney Valley Road to the Harrisburg Expressway. Crash on Franklin Boulevard at 795. Closure for a broken water main, Sudbrook, between Melford Mill and Upland Road. And Arundel County checking in with crashes on Hammond Lane at Ritchie Highway and Ritchie Highway at Walton Avenue. Accident cleared on 50 eastbound at State Park Road, but you are backed up through St. Margaret's. Spend less time lying awake with annoying aches and pains, more time asleep with Advil PM. I'm Joanna Campbell with Baltimore Area Traffic.
Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner.
And I'm Anthony McCarthy. You should hear our conversations during the break. No, you probably should. You're right.
We are talking about the politics of the city and state during the course of this program today. And, of course, as I said later, we'll talk about the Greensboro, North Carolina citizens that took place in 1960. And we really spent some time remembering that and what that means for the future, especially in the heels of the death of Howard Zinn. And we'll hear a bit from Margaret Flowers towards the end of the program, who is co-chair of the Maryland Physicians for a National Health Program, was arrested by the city police and questioned by the Secret Service last week when the president was here. We'll talk about that with her towards the end of this program. But right now, we are joined, Anthony McCarthy and I, who you can hear every Friday in this time slot. He'll be with us again tomorrow as we cover the Governor's State of the State Address and talk to the future mayor of Baltimore. We're joined by Julie Sharper, who is the Baltimore Sun City Hall reporter, Catalina Byrd, who's host of On Point on the Net. I have that right, don't I?
Yes, CatalinaBird.com.
CatalinaBird.com. Thank you, Catalina. CatalinaBird.com. That's Bird with a Y. Hassan Giordano is host of the Reporters Roundtable, host of Speaking Right to the Issues on WOLB, and columnist for the Baltimore Examiner. And, of course, you at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at SteinerShow@gmail.com. But let's – what do you all think this – this new administration is going to look like if, in fact, Jack Young, which all bets look like it could be Jack Young, be the next president of city council, that something blows up the next few days in the world of politics and digging, you never know what people come up with. But what do you think this next – how different will the next couple of years be before the election as opposed to what we've seen before? Let me start with Julie Sharper. What do you think?
I was actually sitting down with a long interview with Councilman Young this morning, and he was talking about his childhood. He's one of 10 children. He grew up in East Baltimore, just a few blocks away from where he lives now. He delivered groceries and shined shoes and sold newspapers, and I think really comes from a different background than a Stephanie Rawlings Blake does, or even Sheila Dixon. I mean, he's someone who really kind of grew up in some pretty tight times, and I think really has stayed in touch with the people in East Baltimore. Stephanie Rawlings Blake, grew up in Ashburton, and I believe Sheila Dixon actually grew up in Ashburton as well. So you kind of have she's really tapped into the East Side world of politics. He's got a really close relationship with Senator McFadden. So, maybe we're going to see some more, more interest on the East Side. And I think that you know, there might be some real sort of grassroots sympathy on his behalf for some of the people dealing with, you know, some of the real serious levels of poverty in our city. You know, from a policy perspective. You know, at the same time, I think he's got a lot of support of members of the council. You know, and there's been a lot of the talk in this, you know, is this a race issue? You know, do Cole's supporters, they supporting him because of his race? But I mean, Jack Young has the support of both black and white council members. You know, if you look at the council itself, they're not really, you know, it's not like they're splitting down the middle because of race for one council president or another. So at this point, he really has assembled a pretty broad coalition of council members behind him. And I think that they're supporting him because they feel that he'll do the best job at advocating for the role of the council. And it's interesting to note, too, that in Stephanie Rawlings Blake, as she was council president, often urged the council members to be more independent from the mayor. She received some criticism along those lines early in her tenure as council president. And I think as the years went by, she really sort of encouraged the other council members to be more independent. So I think they're still in that mindset to... Mm-hmm. A strong degree, even as the person who once urged them to be independent is now becoming mayor.
Catalina and Hassan, your thoughts about where these next couple of years are going to go? How different will they be?
I don't really wish to pontificate from any one perspective as to where it's going to go, but I know where it needs to go. And that is, we need to have a focus on the economy, that we have a deficit. I mean, they're all walking into a crap storm for all intents and purposes. I'm getting better on my language, by the way.
That word was acceptable.
Thank you very much.
Not to get too much further, but that was okay.
But, I mean, I have to be sometimes, I choose to be very, very emphatic about it, because that's mm-hmm. how serious the situation is. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And we have seen for years our school system suffer, the children suffer as a result of it, businesses suffering. And the only other alternative they keep having is to raise property taxes, which makes it difficult to sustain home ownership in the city when it's cheaper for people to move outside and commute back in too. So whether or not he's going to be focused on having the apathy of East Baltimore, I'm not so much concerned with. I think that to come out strong, he has to show himself to be a man of the people for all of the city, as does soon-to-be Mayor Rawlings Blake, not just the areas from which you most frequently come from, or that's not the way to go.
But I think that, as Julie said, Catalina, that narrative is very significant in Baltimore politics. We have seen not only the mayor's of the city recently, but the city council presidents of the most recent come from West Baltimore or Northwest Baltimore. And there is a connection to those communities that these politicians who've come up the ranks like Jack Young have. And he has an affinity of the people of East Baltimore. His story is very much an East Baltimore story. And I think that as long as Jack Young can speak to that narrative and really talk to, because what we're not saying here, and I can say it, I guess, is that as soon as Stephanie Rawlings Blake and as Jack Young become president of the city council and mayor, they have to start running for those positions because that election is next year. And so Jack Young has to solidify a great deal of support from the political machine that he is part of, which is in East Baltimore, as well as Catalina said, begin to reach out and build this broad coalition across the city of people who buy into and support his vision for this city. And I think something very significant that all of our guests really have said, Mark, is that just because there is a disagreement and a difference on who should lead the council right now, do not be surprised if there is not a coming together on these very important broad issues like taxes and the economy after this war is waged and he is elected president of the council. Do not be surprised if he and Stephanie Rawlings do not strike a partnership on how they can move the city forward. That would be smart. That would be prudent for the people of Baltimore. And really, that's what the people of Baltimore have come to expect. There is a certain degree of working together on these big issues.
Hassan Giordano.
Just to let you know, Mark, during the break, the council has broke up. Councilman Jack Young did an interview with Fox and the other, and BAL, I believe, Fox and Channel 2 and Channel 13, where he was speaking to the issue of hiring staff everybody is almost resigned to the fact that he will become the next president. So he was saying hire an experienced staff that still remains from the Stephanie Rawlins Blake administration via council presidency, not those who are going to follow in the mayorship. He's right now in the back room interviewing a very spirited discussion with Jane Miller of BAL. Of course, they've been investigating a particular item that I'm sure you'll see tonight. But just to let you know, that's just a brief update what's going on here in the council. But to your question, Mark, is basically the bottom line is Jack Young is a community guy. You got politicians and you got what some people call social servants, people who serve the people who come from the people. And that's what Jack Young has been all his career. And that's why people can identify with him. He doesn't have to. He's going to have to build a broad base, true. But if you go anywhere in East Baltimore, they'll tell you Jack Young has served them tremendously over the past 12 years. But let's not forget the senators who issued this letter. The main person who issued it, who was the main force behind it, was Senator Lisa Gladden from West Baltimore. And the number two person behind it was Senator Catherine Pugh from West Baltimore. So he has the support of legislative leaders already in West Baltimore. That's because people know that he's a passionate leader. He's been serving the people.
The difference, Hassan, is that they were writing a letter, let's be very specific, that he become the next city council president. That does not in any way, and people, you and anybody else who follows politics in this city, that should not speak to their allegiances when it comes to that election next year.
Well, there's a lot of council people that will probably flip. Let's be real clear that these council people are still leery if Governor O'Malley can win a re-election.
Of course.
If he wins re-election and is able to raise back that money that he has, of course there's going to be people that are going to flip from the council and go over to a possible Bill Cole challenge of Jack Young next year for the position. So we can't really read into what the temperature is going to be like next year. I'm just stating the fact that we know right today.
Well, yeah, we'll see how this all falls out in the next day, and we'll also see what Jane Miller is unearthing, if anything, and on tonight's news. And if it's that earth-shaking, we'll clearly cover it.
Has anybody asked about who's going to take Jack's place, though? Because the city charter demands that the city council put somebody in that seat immediately. While we're all focused on the back and forth of who's going to be the next city council president, who's going to represent his district in his absence?
Well, I think the crass political answer is that East Baltimore organization that he comes from will pick the new city council member, who that is.
And there are two members of that organization who've already served on the city council, Vernon Kreider and I forget the young lady's name, Belinda. Not Belinda.
Belinda Conley?
No. Dynamic young woman over in East Baltimore. She runs one of the youth centers over there. She was on the city council when we had multiple representatives of the district. So don't be surprised if one of those individuals doesn't come back to the council.
Well, the process is you have to submit your name. Anybody can submit
their
name to the council.
You don't even have to live in the district.
Yeah, no. The council as a whole comes together.
But you do have to live in the city.
They have all these applicants in front of the council of the whole. They all sit and you present your case to the council of the whole. Then after that, the council of the whole then makes the suggestion on who they believe should take the 13th district. Then it's forwarded on to the entire city council, and they vote on that process as well. And then that person is placed into that district.
A great deal of deference goes to who the council person wants to take their place.
Right.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's the power of he and his political organization will probably hold sway in who the next person is.
Well, I'm about to ask Councilman Young right
now. You do that and let us know,
Hassan.
Give Jack a hug for me.
Hassan Giordano, thank you so much for being with us. Julie Sharper, great to have you on the air. Thank you so much for all the writing and
great
and
meeting
work
you,
you're doing.
Julie.
Good
thank
to have you,
you
with us. Thank Hope you'll you. Come back. We're going to take a very brief break and come back with Ken Littlebird, Anthony McCarthy, of course, and Charles Robinson, who will be joining us, who is the State Circle, political reporter for State Circle on Maryland Public Television. I'll remind you as we go to this very brief break, the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. We will be back in just a minute. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. And?
Hey, Anthony McCarthy. I'm sorry. I'm trying to do too many check my Facebook. But you know, Mark, the We're going to move into a conversation. We're going to move into a conversation now with Catalina Byrd, of course, who joined us in the last segment. We're also going to be joined by Charles Robinson of Maryland Public Television in State Circle. Of course, you can see Charles when the legislature's in session. He is on site all the time, bringing us the late breaking news from Annapolis and what's happening at the General Assembly. Of course, Mark Steiner is here with us, as always, the Mark Steiner Show.
I better be here.
You better be here. I'm going to ask for more money. Anyway, but this is a very important issue, Mark. You and I have been talking about it for weeks, and I'm sure Charles Robinson and Catalina Byrd, their sources have been sharing little bits and pieces with them as well, Mark, that there is some talk, a great deal of talk in political circles, that Martin O'Malley is going to be challenged by more than just former legislator George Owings in the Democratic primary, and that the former Prince George's County executive, Wayne Curry, who's now working with the Murphy Law Firm here in the city of Baltimore, may throw his hat in the ring to challenge Martin O'Malley for the nomination of the Democrats for governor.
And on Mark Plotkin's show in Washington, he said he would not run with Governor Robert Ehrlich.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
But would make an announcement about what he's going to do at the end of the session. And this is an interesting wrinkle in this race. I mean, there's all kinds of people saying, well, you know, they talk to Curry, and his wife says, please, I don't want you to run. So, and is that going to stop you from running? So, well, I'm not sure. So, I mean, all kinds of politicians play a lot of games about run, yes, no, what. But this is a very important question. This is more important than the Owings challenge, conservative mm-hmm. kind of I was going to say something bad, but I was going to say that I won't say that. But George, but on the right of the party,
that's right,
mm-hmm. As opposed to George Curry, who not necessarily left of the party, but
Wayne Curry,
mm-hmm. me, but he represents as the former county executive, Prince George's County, as a significant challenge from an African American to Martin O'Malley's governorship. So let's talk about that and what it might mean. Charles Robbins, let me start with you since you're all over this. I think.
Well, Mark, first of all, you know, it's good to hear from you guys. You coming down tomorrow?
We'll see you tomorrow.
We'll be there tomorrow.
Of course, we'll have the State of the State, and, of course, Maryland Public Television will carry it live. Wayne Curry, first of all, did you guys notice that Wayne Curry and Larry Hogan actually did some work in the Ehrlich administration?
Well, I did know that, and Wayne Curry actually talked about that.
Always is, you know, that's always tricky. You know, because, you know, when Ehrlich got into office, Wayne Curry pulled me aside at the governor's mansion one afternoon. He says, I'm going to challenge Martin O'Malley. I'm going to challenge. And he did the same thing that he did to you guys when he said, well, you know, my wife wants me to make some money. And I was like, okay, I'll wait around and see what happens when it comes time. And, you know, cynics would suggest to you that part of this kind of toying, if you will, is to find out where the edges are for the governor. Mm. And if you look at Hogan, who was the secretary of the Veterans Administration in the Ehrlich administration, it's a constituency that the governor has never won, despite the fact that his dad was a World War II veteran, and that Ehrlich has often courted when he was both a politician and a candidate for various office that he resonates with. When you talk about Wayne Curry, you actually have to go back to Paris Glendinning. He and Paris Glendinning were not on good terms.
No, they were not.
And in fact, and you remember this, Mark, the deficit that Glendinning left Curry left him with few viable options.
Just to step back for a minute, Governor Glendinning, before he became governor, was county executive of Prince George's County. Wayne Curry became the county executive
after him. Right. It was his successor.
Right.
And so you have these two. And then I note that it seems like everybody in this race says, "Well, if Ehrlich gets in, I'm stepping out." And I chuckle because the Republican Party in this state does not have a deep bench. And you know, and I've asked the ex-governor about this. He says, "Well, yeah, we've got some people, but note that there is nobody like Ehrlich when it comes to fundraising who is a Republican. People suggest it's Michael Steele, but the numbers prove it's not Steele's popularity, it's Ehrlich's popularity that drives the numbers when it comes to fundraising. So as we look, ahead real quickly, and I'll finish here, is that I think a couple of things you want to watch. First of all, the anger of black Prince Georgians, and Wayne Curry will tell them, don't call them PGNs, call them Prince Georgians,
right.
That it is not as loud as you would think it is. It's great visually, but it's not loud. Ask Jack Johnson and ask, what's her name, Congresswoman.
Donna Edwards.
Donna Edwards, what they said after they went to the Wayne Curry birthday party, and that they were not endorsing Wayne Curry, but to be seen as to be heard, as Wayne Curry will tell you.
Well, I mean, what would it mean? Speculate for a moment, what this all means. But now for Governor Martin O'Malley, and especially what it might mean if Wayne Curry was to really announce that he's going to run in this primary. And I wonder what our listeners think at 410-319-8888.
I don't think I don't think O'Malley sweats it, because...
Well, wait a minute. Let me just get the other panelists to kind of chime in, then we'll come right back. Catalina? And
he's not sweating it, then he is...
Is Catalina's mic on? Okay, go ahead.
If he's not sweating it, then that is poor. He's already given up his political career and must be getting ready to go write books or work the lecture circuit, because the power that was in that room, the thing that people don't identify with, some people were there just to be seen and heard, but there were a number of key Republicans in that room. Republicans nationally always raise more money and have better strategy. It's just that in this state, in Democratic state, they don't win much. But he was very, very key. He was one of the fundraising machines in PG County for Governor Early. And I come from the standpoint I worked on those campaigns in 2002 and 2006.
Whose campaigns?
Governor Early. And then when they severed and Michael Steele ran for Senate in 06, we had so little volunteers and or staff for that necessarily that we had to double for both campaigns on the Early Cox ticket. So I think that from what I've heard and the people that I know, and as Wayne as well, is that he's not ruling out a Curry Ehrlich ticket. What he's saying is that he will not change his party, which if you saw Ehrlich change his party, actually wouldn't seem all that strange, because we lost in 06 because he'd lost most of his conservative base for being too moderate on things and doing what the people wanted for the state of Maryland. And that would be a very powerful and dynamic ticket. And for once, it would make people have to look beyond partisanship and look at the body of work and what you're getting before you.
And I believe that Martin O'Malley will sweat this, only in that if African Americans decide to sit out this election, he is going to need them as part of that coalition against Bob Ehrlich, if Bob Ehrlich is the Republican nominee. And if for some reason Wayne Curry is able to tap into the fact that the Democrats haven't fielded a statewide African American candidate, the Democrats, for all of the talk about inclusiveness, they did have Michael Cryer as their chairperson, but majority of the leadership of the Democratic Party in this state of Maryland lined up with Hillary Clinton in the primary against Barack Obama. I think that there is enough young, professional African Americans who are aligned with the Democratic Party who do not believe this party is moving fast enough to put African Americans in positions of power. And they believe that this party, the Democratic Party, is not progressive enough on African American issues. They can tap into that, and they're taken for granted. Wayne Curry could tap into that. That could be a problem for Martin O'Malley. I really do believe that his coalition of campaign leadership, if he's not sweating it, as Charles said, they're sweating it.
Oh, definitely.
So I we'll have to wait till the end of March, obviously.
Of course.
but I mean, I think, and what you were just saying, Kathleen, I was just trying to read what was in the this morning that was in Central Maryland, and what they say though is that when Mark Plotkin asked Curry about what you were speculating on, he said that Curry also ruled out switching parties. Some have speculated that Curry is contemplating running on a ticket with former Governor Robert Ehrlich Jr., a move that would require Curry to become Republican, though it would not.
But it
No. By law, he would. And remember, Nancy Grasmick
had
to change her. She changed her registration. That was one of the indicators that she was under serious consideration.
Because Maryland has closed primaries. One of them would have to change their party,
yeah,
but it wouldn't have to necessarily be
good
Wayne.
Point.
Well, yeah, but
Ehrlich's
not going to become a Democrat. I mean, and Curry said to Mark Plotkin, "I could never do that. I've been a Democrat all my life. I'll always be a Democrat."
Or Ehrlich could become an independent. See, we're one of few states that has closed primaries, and
that,
when
none
you
of
go,
that's going to happen, though, Catalina.
I don't think that we can rule that out, I don't think that we can rule that
out. The only way Bob Ehrlich runs is that he's running on this tide in Virginia, New Jersey, Massachusetts of Republicans making inroads. He has to run as a Republican.
And Hogan dropped out today.
It's not going to work here in Maryland.
Larry Hogan
said he's not going to run.
Which is another indicator that Bob Ehrlich has already indicated he's going to run.
And I'm sorry, you still with us?
I'm sorry, Charles.
Jump in with your thoughts on all this that you've heard our guests say.
Right. Well, the other thing that you have to look at is you have to look at the empirical numbers. The state in its fringes has large Republican majorities. We have, whether you like it or not, combining both the western portion of the state and the eastern shore does not give you enough to erase the juggernaut in the middle. And understand that when Ehrlich won the last time, he had what we call the perfect storm in politics. And if you look at Coakley, what happened to her up in Massachusetts, some of it's there, but the one thing that is missing is a candidate who squanders her popularity. Mm-hmm. I mean, think about it. Kathleen Kennedy Townsend. I don't care what anybody says. She was a horrible candidate. I said it many times on both of yours ears back then. I said she is a horrible candidate, and I think you get a little bit different mood that's going on. So the things that I think Ehrlich has going for him is first of all, there is a mood in the country that gives him probably more than a 65% chance of winning that group. The other part is that the state itself, because it is this northern kind of buffer against sometimes Republican tides, you do have to worry about voter turnout. As I always say, don't let it rain or don't let it snow. This is not a state that people will go to the polls in that.
We don't go to school if it snows.
Right. But think about what happened in Massachusetts. It snowed that day. There is a sentiment out there in the general public that should frighten both Republicans and Democrats. And I remind Republicans, don't think those Tea Party folks are for you. In many instances, they want to take you out if you're an incumbent. But my last little thing is this. Look, I think this kind of, we got to wait until after the legislative process is over with, mm-hmm. is crucial to kind of have a build-up. I'll just tell you, we've already recorded the Republican response to the governor's state of the state, and I watched it. And I thought the thing that was very interesting, and then I was watching some other political shows, was that there has been these dog and pony shows of showing charts and stuff. And I'm going to tell you, there are going to be more charts and flow charts than you have ever seen in a political campaign this year.
Mm. 410-319-8888. Your thoughts on this potential race between Wayne Curry, former county executive of Prince George's County, challenging Governor Martin O'Malley for the Democratic nomination to be the next governor of the state of Maryland. There's a lot of rumor out here. There's a lot of push. Whether it amounts to anything, this could all be rumor. But if it did happen, let's say it did happen, and let's say Martin O'Malley won the primary, which I think he probably would. This my rolling the dice right now is what I think he would in this race. It would beat him up so bad that former Governor Robert Ehrlich would just be salivating at the thought of Wayne Curry running against Martin O'Malley. 410-319-8888, and then I'll ask Catalina why she's shaking her head no. We'll find out about that. With Corrigan, you're on the air.
Hey, good evening.
Good evening, Corrigan.
Is that my? I hear my beautiful friend there with you too, and I ain't talking about Anthony.
Hi, Corrigan.
Hey, how are you?
I'm good.
And my brother Anthony,
hey.
How are you?
Corrigan, we're running out of time, so
real quick. Wayne Curry would not have to change parties to be on Governor Ehrlich's ticket.
He would.
One of the
yes,
things.
Yes, he would.
Yes, he would.
Well, let me give you an example. The admiral that ran with Kennedy Townsend never changed his party. And he was Republican.
No, he did. I
he think. Did. He changed his party.
He changed his party. He became a Democrat.
And then the day after, turned back. But the interesting thing about it is that if Wayne Curry did run against Martin O'Malley. It's a win-win situation for Governor Ehrlich, because the reason why he lost the last time was not that he was a bad governor, but they tied the war and George W. Bush around his neck. Yeah. This time, people are upset with this present governor. And the big question is not so much if the governor is going to run, but is his lieutenant governor is going to stay on the ticket.
I don't even think that matters.
I don't think.
What has been you even hear them speak about Anthony Brown as lieutenant governor. He's not visible or anything that's that powerful. I mean, almost to the extent, sadly, he served his purpose much like Michael did. And if he severs off and runs for something else, it'll be irrelevant. The fact that what Corrigan said is true. We lost in 2006, not because of what kind of governor Robert Ehrlich was, but because they did a fantastic job of tying him and George W. Bush and the war in Iraq and the national temperature and climate feeling about the war to him specifically, juxtaposing every picture they've ever seen Bob Ehrlich take with George W. Bush and making them seem one and the same when their administrations were two totally different things.
I don't know. What do you think about that, Charles?
Well, she is right in the sense that the election was nationalized, and they ran in a period of time when the country was ready. I hate to say this word, it was ready for change, and it was of that ilk. And because I've always told folk, you know, Bob Ehrlich, whether you liked him or not, he balanced the daggone budget. He did some things that people didn't like, but, you know, he balanced it, you know, and that's 80.
Well, I mean, I don't want to get into a political argument over this because I don't care one way or the other, and I usually am neutral in these elections, but
sitting in the HBCU that he gave a number of money to.
Except that the budget was balanced on the backs of the money that we took from somewhere else and raising taxes, but he said weren't taxes. I mean,
to the world of shift and spend.
I think there's a lot more to Governor Ehrlich's losing than that. And I think
But understand this: that at the end of the day, Ehrlich could succinctly tell his constituents, "I didn't raise your taxes." He raised every damn fee in the state. But he didn't raise taxes. You know,
he just raised fees.
It's totally about semantics. But look, at the end of the day, you know, there are some cards that are dealt to you that you can't play with. You know, for those of you who are poker fans out there, if you will, you know, you can't win with a pair of threes if somebody else has got kings. And in this case, that's what happened to Ehrlich in the second go-round. The first go-round, he had kings. Second go-round, he had threes. And you have to play with the hand that you dealt with. You know, I talked to the governor when they did the big rally on the first night, and I can tell you, he was buoyant. He was effusive. He was all of that. I asked him, "So why are these people got all these signs out here for you?" "Well, Charles, they must like me." I said, "Yeah, they sure enough do." And, you know, and I think it will be a very spirited race. And I anticipate, you know, there is no doubt in my mind the ex-governor is going to run. He told me that he hadn't made up his mind like 4 months before that. After that, I was like, "Governor, stop joking. You're going to run." And he is raising money, and right now he's in a slight deficit, but I think money will turn around for him. And you know what? It will be a battle of ideas, but it will also be a battle on the airways. Mark, I hate to do this to you, but I got to go teach a class because there's some young people who want to do what you do, and I've got to teach them.
Excuse me, you're teaching these days?
Yes, I always teach. I teach on Monday nights in Howard County.
I'm just teasing you, man.
All right.
Take care. Joshua Robinson. Right,
you're welcome.
Political reporter for State Circle.
It's always fun when Charles and I can be on the same. He did my show. I like Charles.
I like Charles too.
He has a very great perspective. But I think the problem for Wayne, if he gets out the primary, that no one thinks about, is that he's very well known in PG and Montgomery County. I'm sorry, Prince George's. But not as well known in the city. But then you think about who he's aligned with, who, for all intents and purposes, has a lot of money and pull in the city. He's at the Murphy firm. I think establishing a Baltimore City presence for him to make those votes convey will not be difficult. And you've already kind of sort of saw, as Charles just alluded to, a battle over the airwaves. You've seen it begin in his appearances on Square Off.
Let us get, and we'll try to have Mr. Curry on the show as soon as we can.
As soon as we can, yeah.
410-319-8888. Let's go to Gabe and Perry Hall before we go to break.
Thanks for taking my call.
Thanks for calling.
Look, one of the things that really infuriates me is the attention span of the voting public.
Hallelujah.
You know, the Republicans have, you have to give it to them, they don't waver from their mantra of no taxes. And what does no taxes give us? They gave us the economic devastation that, you know, political leaders, particularly governors, have had to deal with for the past, you know, 4 years. And we're just starting to have some recovery from it, from the leadership that we have in Washington now. But, you know, when the commentary treats it sort of like it didn't happen, you know, I think it does a disservice to the public. Ehrlich did nothing for us. He, like, talked the talk with no taxes, but raised fees. So this whole misrepresentation and hypocrisy just has to be called out. And, you know, I look for you guys to do that.
Well, this is going to be a very interesting election year, and we intend to cover it pretty intensely. Anthony McCarthy and I will be down at the State of the State tomorrow, bringing that report back to you here tomorrow night. I think that the problem we've seen from whether the questions I asked Governor Martin O'Malley at our
Annapolis summit,
or the questions I asked Governor Ehrlich when he was governor of the state of Maryland, when other times, is that they always dance around the issues of what are you going to do with the real issues of the shortfall in state government, and nobody wants to wrestle with that or lay it on the table for us honestly, because if you did, people would shudder, and you really have to think of some serious responses and be creative in ways that you're not even contemplating in politics right now.
You mean answer a question without talking points?
Yes, and with some real responses.
My goodness.
Catalina Byrd, host of On Point at CatalinaByrd.com.
Yes.
Always good to have you here.
Thank you.
And I'm glad your son was with you again. He's a great kid.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Anthony McCarthy, we'll be right back.
We'll be right back.
We're going to take a very brief break and come back and talk about the 50th anniversary of the first sit-in and talk to Dr. Margaret Flowers. And the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. Stop by one of its 7 branches or go to MECU.com for more information. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner.
I'm Anthony McCarthy.
Of course, Anthony McCarthy here every Monday. He's here Tuesday as well. Who knows how many more days this week
That's
he might
right.
be.
We may do it all the time.
We may do it all the time. of course, he has his own show here every Friday in this time slot at 5 to 7 p.m. on Fridays. And he's a senior media fellow at the Center for Emerging Media that produces both of our programs. The number here is 410-319-8888. Before we turn to Dr. Margaret Flowers, and maybe Margaret Flowers can help us reflect on this, we bring on the air as well. I wanted you to reflect on it with us for a minute at 410-319-8888. This is the 50th anniversary today, February the 1st, of the student sit-in at the whites-only Woolworth lunch counter in Greensboro, North Carolina. And I want to remember these 4 men who stood there, sat there, I should say, and created a revolution when they refused to move to begin the center, the power of the movement that already started, but the power of the movement to end segregation in this country. Franklin McCain, Joseph McNeil, Ezell Blair Lee, and David Richmond sat at that lunch counter. And today, that lunch counter has become something new. Today, that lunch counter was dedicated as the International Civil Rights Center and Museum, and which is just amazing that they turned that Woolworth counter
into. Isn't that something?
And this is something that, for those of us who were in the civil rights movement as young people, who sat in, were inspired by those sit-ins, who began sitting here in Baltimore, Maryland, at places like the White Coffee Pot and Reed's Drugstore and all the other places in downtown Baltimore and the Knights of Columbus, the Catholic organization wouldn't let black folks in back in 1960, that those places where we sat in, the inspiration came from these 4 men who sat at that counter and people who had coffee poured over their heads, cigarettes burned out in their arms, being beaten by white mobs. And some people have thought that in this – a few days ago we honored Howard Zinn, who just died, who wrote The People's History of the United States. We need to think about what they stood up for and what we need to think about standing up for in America. Mantha, you weren't born yet.
No. But you know, Mark, those images are so real. And I don't take for granted you.
I know you
don't. And what a blessing it is that you're not only a great colleague, but a good friend. And we talk about this. We talk about the call. And I'm sure Margaret Flowers is going to explain to us her passion and why she believes that you have to stand up. Mark, those images that my grandmother shared with me, my mother told me stories about people who suffered great indignity. Like these young men who sat at that counter and were just treated like they weren't human.
They were not
human. I sit on this radio station. I've had opportunities to work at the White House. I've gone to great colleges because people like those men mm-hmm. sat down at that counter.
Mm-hmm.
And as you said, you and thousands upon thousands of people were inspired to step out of our comfort zones. Based on the movement that was started when they said, no, I'm not going to do this anymore. I'm not going to take my food from the back window. I'm not going to be refused service. And they sat down at that counter. And the images, I've only seen it in film, but the images of what happened to them as they sat there and they fought back the desire, as all of us would have had, to fight back and suffered so that I'd have a chance to be here, you'd have a chance to do what you did.
You know, it's interesting that then we'll bring Margaret into this. This was 1960. I was 13, almost 14. They sat in on February the 1st, and then students from Morgan State University.
That's right.
Formed the Civic Interest Group and began demonstrating at Northwood Shopping Center and at Mondawmin, believe it or not, Mondawmin Shopping Center, which many of our listeners shop in today, was a place that did not welcome black folks to sit down or shop in that shopping center. I remember the day that my mother and I were shopping there when I was a kid, and we saw these, well, then you would say Negro students picketing at the White Coffee Pot and sitting in the White Coffee Pot. And I asked my mother if I could join the picket line. She said, well, I asked the captain, and we did, and I joined that picket line, and I wanted so badly to sit in, but they wouldn't let me do it until I was 16. Then I did, and I was arrested immediately. But the young people at Morgan State University then really stood up for something. You know, I mean, they were not afraid to be arrested. They were not afraid to be beaten.
Hundreds of them,
and that's what changed this country. And sometimes you have to think about what changes America, what wakes it up. Sometimes it seems like the far right is what's waking up to that mass action now. Those guys were just arrested at Landreau's office.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't really condemn those men for what they did. They have a belief that they believe in, and they're fighting for it and willing to put their lives on the line. That's what you have to do if you want to change something in America or anywhere in this country. You have to be willing to put your life on the line. Was it that Martin Luther King, and others said that if you don't have something to you that is worth dying for, then it's not worth living for. I mean, you got to be able to make a sacrifice to change things in this country.
And that's why, Mark, sometimes, and I'm sure Dr. Flowers will probably agree, sometimes you get so frustrated with the pettiness and shallowness of the public servants, and I'm using that term lightly, that we have of today. Because there were men and women of extraordinary courage and conscience, black and white, who had to make tough decisions
mm-hmm.
About life and death. And I just admire. I wish we had men and women in public office today who just took that commitment so seriously that they were willing to die for it.
And even though there were other sit-ins and funeral rides that took place in 1948, there was something about this pinnacle moment in 1960 that changed everything. Let me open the phones and also bring Margaret Flowers in here. Michael Johnson, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Good evening. How are you guys?
Hey,
well,
Michael.
Fine. You know, I was glad you said the last quote that you said in the end, because, you know, a lot of people don't understand about Carolyn Parks and a gentleman named Ron Waters.
Right.
Yeah, back
yes.
in 1958 in Kansas City. Because many of the student marches, student demonstration at the time, actually played off of this, which was the Dockham drugstore, which a lot of people, you know, was a huge, huge drugstore. It was a part of the Rexall company, and they went in 2 years before, and did this. And the difference between one or the other is how people interpret African American or interpret the civil rights struggle. Mm-hmm. The reason that you didn't hear about it was because the newspaper didn't want to lose advertisers about advertising it.
Oh, no, there's no question. I mean, one of the things that, you know, there's a book, his name I'm blocking on, which is terrible, that was written about the African-American press during the Civil Rights Movement. And it was the black reporters from the Chicago Defender and the Baltimore Afro-American, the Washington Afro-American, and the other black newspapers in this country, the Amsterdam News, that risked their lives and were beaten badly to cover the story and forced the Washington Post and the New York Times to wake up at this point to cover what was going on in the early 60s that they ignored completely in the late 50s. And that's reality. And you're right, Michael. I mean, and Michael, are you doing well, man, by the way, before we go to our guest?
Yes, and I know you guess it, and you don't have a lot of time. I just don't want to take away from, obviously, what happened with my friends down in North Carolina, A&T, the Aggies. I'm just saying that sometimes you have to find out where it comes from before you know where it ends. And it started at this particular location that made a lot of difference because 2 years later the students quoted this particular demonstration. So I'll sit back and listen to the rest. And, yes, I'm fine. Thank you, Mark.
It's good to hear from you, man.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Michael founded and is running the Paul Robeson Institute.
Right. And rumors are that he may run for city council.
That's a rumor.
410-319-8888.
We'll find out soon.
410-319-8888 is the number here. Let me introduce to you now Margaret Flowers. Margaret Flowers, who has been a guest on the show numerous times before, is co-chair of the Maryland Physicians for the National Health Program and the Congressional – what's the name of that? What's that title again, Margaret?
Congressional Fellow.
Congressional Fellow with the National Physicians. Group where she lobbies and advocates for a single-payer system in this country. And I was having a meeting Friday afternoon at the Stone Mill Bakery, and in one's Margaret Flowers, who walked over to me and said, Mark, I've just come back from being arrested. So tell us what happened, Margaret.
Sure. Thank you, Mark. Thank you for having me on.
Good to have you here.
Certainly I take great inspiration from those who have come before and fought for social justice. And I agree with what Anthony said about, you know, there were so many that suffered great indignity, and we see that today in the healthcare injustices that happen in this country. So, you know, I've been working very hard to push for a Medicare for All national health program that would cover everybody in this country and improve our health outcomes. And on Wednesday night, the president gave his State of the Union, and during his address he said, if anybody has an approach that will lower premiums, cover the uninsured, stabilize Medicare, eliminate pre-existing conditions, let me know. So I immediately wrote an open letter to the president, which was published, letting him know that Medicare for All would achieve those goals and more. And I tried to deliver that to the White House on Thursday morning. I went down there with a packet of information and my letter, and there were people calling to let the White House know that I was coming. And when I got to the gate, they wouldn't take the papers. I asked if they would call a staffer to come and greet me and take the papers, and they said no. So on Thursday, we learned that the president was coming to Baltimore on Friday. So Dr. Carol Paris joined me, and we went down to the Renaissance Harbor Hotel, hoping that we could hand-deliver the letter there, because we'd been told if it's mailed, it takes, you know, 4 weeks at least. It has to go through all these processes, and then you never know who gets it. So we stood there outside the hotel with a banner that said, letting you know, Medicare for All, and had our packet of information. And when they asked us to move, we said we would move if they could call somebody on the staff to come and speak to us. And they said no. And it was really telling, because one of the Secret Service agents looked at us and he said, you know, we have to arrest you. We're just doing our job. And Dr. Paris and I looked at each other and we said, you know, we're just doing our job because we have to take care of patients and we can't do that in this environment. So they arrested us, and ironically, as we sat in the central headquarters in handcuffs, the president said to the Republican caucus, if anybody has an approach to health care reform that will meet these goals and that's supported by doctors, nurses, and health experts, let me know. And that's exactly what we were trying to do, because the majority of doctors do support this approach, and certainly the nurses do. And the health experts all agree this is how we need to solve our problems.
And before I ask you one final question, I have a few minutes left. Now, Anthony, please jump in here. I think what you're doing is also in the spirit of what we talked about earlier, that people in America have to begin to really stand up and be counted in terms of what they believe in this new America we have to fight for. It's a very critical time in our country's history. And I think what you're doing, yeah. Margaret, is part of that.
And I think, Mark, a lot of people criticize. You know, you and I have given honest critiques of this administration on our show. Guests have called in and certainly entitled to their opinion. But I think one of the great things is that we've been called to these moments to really speak out, not just for ourselves, but for those constituencies. You and I represent our own personal beliefs, but we also represent a listenership that demands that we ask the tough questions. And that's why I just love what Margaret did. And I know that there probably some of our listeners are saying, oh, you know, this president is doing everything he can. But you know what? Margaret's a doctor. She's made a pledge that she will do no harm and that she will speak up for those who can't speak for themselves. And so I just get real emotional when people stand up for what they believe in and who they believe in. And it's not that we don't believe in Barack Obama, but we definitely believe that America is not living up to its potential. And we're a great nation, but we have to meet that standard.
Well, thank you. And we knew that electing the president was just a first step.
That's right.
That if we want him to live up to the ideals of this nation, we have to be behind him and push him to do it. And we do that by our demonstrations of pushing him to do things on the issues that serve the people.
Margaret Flowers.
He can be the best he can be.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
All right, go ahead. No, sorry.
Congressional fellow for the Physicians for a National Health Program, who was arrested at trying to deliver an alternative to our healthcare system demanding Medicare for all, suggesting Medicare for all as a way to solve or begin to solve our healthcare crisis in America, was arrested, questioned by the Secret Service and let go, and has been a guest on the show before and will be here again. And as we talk about what the next steps are for national healthcare, we'll have Dr. Margaret Flowers with us. It's always a pleasure to talk to you, Margaret. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me, Mark and Anthony. Take care.
Our pleasure.
Okay, bye-bye.
And speaking of healthcare, I want you to join Healthcare for the Homeless for the sweetest night in town.
And it's a sweet night.
Yes, it is. The 19th Annual Chocolate Affair. Sample more than 50 of Baltimore's best restaurants, caterers, and chocolatiers while raising the resources and awareness necessary to end homelessness. The Chocolate Affair is Thursday, February the 4th from 6 to 9:30 p.m. at M&T Bank Stadium. Tickets and more information are available at chocolateaffair.org. Anthony McCarthy, see you tomorrow morning.
See you tomorrow morning, bright and early, as we head to Annapolis.
The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. We're produced by Justin Levy. We're engineered by Brian Boone. Our interns are Judith Lloyd, Brian Boone, Richard Good, Gay Pinder, and Marianne Amos. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, and to hear new additional interviews, visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by MECU, Baltimore's credit union, and the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development.